Welcome to Conservation Unfiltered, a podcast all about the North American model of conservation and your chance to dive into conversations about trends, research, and outdoor activities. Now let's get wild.
Part of me has this romantic vision of, you know, National Park Service or Fish and Wildlife Service doing their, you know, annual biodiversity counts of birds and pollinators, on the White House having, you know, Secret Service out there, you know, shepherding some folks around to check some camera traps for foxes on the White House grounds.
Welcome back once again, everybody, to another episode of the Conservation Unfiltered podcast presented by Conserve the Wild. I'm your host, Jason Creighton, and this is episode number 87, What to Do with the 30 by 30 Initiative. Now, yes, today we're going to be talking about the 30 by 30 Initiative. For those of you that may not know, the 30 by 30 Initiative is pretty simple. It's an initiative put forth by the Biden administration to conserve 30% of land and water by the year 2030. There's a whole host of reasons that the Biden administration goes into as far as why this is important. And we're not going to be taking this deep dive into the nuts and bolts of 30 by 30 because it's pretty broad and pretty vague. What we are going to do today is I am going to be talking with two PhDs, Max Lambert and Desiree Naragno, about their article and what they want to see the Biden administration and congressmen and the city of D.C., among other cities, do with the 30 by 30 initiative. Now, quick background, Max Lambert is an urban biologist. He's a conservation biologist. Basically, he studies how to get animals to survive and thrive in cities and suburbs. Desiree is a postdoctoral researcher in the biology department at University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's a 2020 David H. Smith Conservation Research Fellow, and her research focuses on understanding habitat relationships and plant-animal interactions in human-dominated landscapes. Now, those two, with their credentials, work perfectly with what Conserve the Wild is trying to do, which is mitigate the effects of urbanization. And their article, Biodiversity Conservation Should Start in Biden's Backyard, is exactly what we're going to be talking about today, among a couple other things, a little bit of background before that. If you want to read their article, it's linked down there in the show notes. Go ahead and click on it, go to that article. If you want to read it before you listen. If you don't, if you want to listen, go into this episode fresh and maybe come back to the article later, well, let's get right to it. So welcome back, everyone. As you heard in the intro, I'm joined by two guests today, Desiree and Max. How are both of you? Doing good today?
Doing lovely.
Wonderful. How are you doing?
I'm always doing good. Anytime I get to talk about the outdoors, wildlife conservation, I'm always having a good time. That's something that I can talk about for hours, and everyone in my family is probably sick of me talking about. So it's good that I have this other outlet and other people to talk to about these subjects. So what we're going to talk about today is the 30 by 30 initiative, which came probably about 2 months ago from the Biden administration, which is to conserve 30% of land and water by the year 2030. It's an initiative, right? So can we get a little brief explanation? Because as we talked about before this, it's a little bit vague in what exactly it's expecting people to do. Can we just have a real brief explanation of just sort of what, or a brief introduction into what the 30 for 30 is, 30 by 30, sorry.
Sure.
So I'll clarify one thing quickly, which is I think neither of us are experts on 30 by 30, but also 30 by 30 as a concept has actually gone back in time a little, lot farther than this 2 months ago. That's kind of when it became a federal initiative. But the broad goal is to protect 30% of land and water by the year 2030. as a big conservation goal for climate change, for biodiversity crisis, for a whole host of other, you know, needs for humanity and for the environment. California's taking progress towards 30 by 30 itself, just not too long ago either. But it is kind of a larger conceptual issue that's been going on in conservation for a chunk of time now.
Yeah, I would also say, you know, it's not just the United States either. It's kind of a commitment that we're speaking to that's also joined by, I think, 50 or more other countries that are saying that they'll also commit to conserving 30% of their countries, of their nations by 2030. And, you know, this goes all along with a lot of other kind of great initiatives that are happening right now, like the UN saying that this is the decade of restoration. Like, people are committing to making change. And so, you know, part of what this administration is also committing to is thinking about conservation in a new way. So not just thinking about the, you know, about 10% or so of land that's currently conserved in national parks or national monuments or in protected areas, but to broaden what our thinking is about conserved land in general, and also bringing more people to that conversation. Part of the language also speaks to getting in community involvement, indigenous people involvement as well, as we think about how we're actually going to reach this, which is where the vague part comes in. And what we would like to speak to today is that when we think about how are we going to reach 30%, which is incredibly ambitious, we have to really think about novel approaches.
You know, as a lifelong hunter, I look back at the time of the late 1800s, early 1900s, and specifically, you know, Theodore Roosevelt and as president doing major, major things to help wildlife conservation. And I sort of look back at that with like reverence, like the fact that there were people that were willing to walk the walk and do what needed to be done to help wildlife to the best of their ability at that time. And to now see something like this and see it as an opportunity where I can live through something similar in my own lifetime, and maybe even help be a part of that restoration, I think that is a tremendous, tremendous opportunity that I think will only benefit us. You know, it might take some readjustment, but it will benefit us. So why is this 30 by 30 initiative important? Like, what, who cares, right? Like, we're the human species. If we're ruining landscapes for wildlife, like, who cares? We can just add a new technology, right? Come up with new technology and fix it, right? Like, who cares about climate change? Let's just build this real big sunshade that blocks out a bunch of the sun. Like, we've used technology to fix so much. Why is technology not going to work? And this initiative is the way to go.
Oh man, technology for biodiversity declines. that's a tricky thread to weave together. But I really like that you brought up the hunter example, because, you know, there was a recent paper in Science that came out that showed that we've lost 3 billion birds in the last 50 years. But, you know, some of the birds that are doing great are the ones that are hunted. So our waterfowl species, some of our game bird species, like turkeys. Turkeys are a conservation success story. And part of the reason that, you know, incorporating hunters into conservation has worked so well is that, you know, hunters are in the role of an earth steward. So they are taking care of the animals and that they need and the habitats that wildlife needs to survive. And so, you know, this 30 by 30 initiative is all about that too. And that's, you know, that's kind of what we're speaking to, is that we need to all be stewards of land in unique ways. And the, you know, part of the reason that technology is not going to save some of these biodiversity, the biodiversity crisis, and save the species that are declining at these alarming rates, we see birds, insects, our reptiles and amphibians, we're losing plants. The reason we need these ambitious goals is because of scale, and we need to scale up from the conservation that we've already done and make sure that we're thinking about more land across the landscape, and also protecting habitat that connects pieces of land, because that's kind of what conservation has done for the longest time in this country, is basically act as islands. We have silos of beautiful, amazing protected areas, and yet even when we protect our plants and wildlife in a national park, we're seeing declines. We're seeing that the species are not bouncing back. And part of that is because that national park is disconnected from the rest of the habitat out there. And so, what this 30 by 30 can do, and then also us as we, join in that campaign, is to start bridging the connections of habitat that we need to make these populations sustainable.
Max, I see you shaking your head as she's talking about silos. obviously, I can tell that you agree. What more do you have to say on that sort of subject?
Yeah, the one that I keep thinking about, Desiree talked about the idea of scale, and you mentioned something previously about kind of things shifting kind of over time. Even with land that you protect, we kind of play this awkward game of ping pong with protected spaces, right? How often do we go from president to president taking a wildlife refuge and going to go drill on it just to have it protected again by the next president, and back and forth? And so this idea of scale, I think, is so critical, because any particular parcel or area we choose to protect may become unprotected from whatever reason down the road. And so having enough of these, enough of the landscape protected has a little bit of buffer against that stochasticity that humans always like to throw into the mix. And that's why it's really important to have, scale, big chunks of land that are protected and water that are protected, but also, have that distributed across the whole country, whole world, as much as possible. And that led itself to some interesting, thinking about what's the land use that undergoes that landscape, because the world at this point in time, we aren't going from protected space to not protected space. We're going from places that are heavily impacted by agriculture, forestry operations, urbanization. And so all that, adds complexity to what we're protecting and how we're trying to restore that which has not been protected for a long time. So that's just kind of where I think about the scale and kind of the timeline that we had to work with, because we're always kind of playing that ping pong game.
So I love this idea of silos, right? And I don't want to say that the easiest way to protect and conserve land is with national parks, federally managed land, because it's not easy to do that. And like you said, it can be sort of, who knows, based on what administration's in office, whether it's going to continue that way. But I feel like we have this wonderful opportunity to conserve land sort of on a private scale with conservation easements, right? Because when you set up a conservation easement, that's in perpetuity. It doesn't matter who's in office. It doesn't matter who owns the land. It has that restriction of activity that can be done on that land that is typically going to be good for conservation moving forward. Is that a viable option to try to incentivize?
I mean, it's certainly an option. People do at large scales kind of everywhere in the world. And it definitely works. And it works for certain kinds of landscapes, but Desiree and I both work in cities, and you really can only do easements on so many kind of city parcels. But forests, agricultural landscapes, easements they can be a great option.
Yeah, I think especially from our perspective, again, working in urban and suburban landscapes, it's less about, let's come in and restrict the amount of development that's going to happen, because the development has already happened, right? We need to think about how can we go from there and restore it back to something that's more ecologically functional. And so kind of the similar program that comes to mind is the CRP program, the Conservation Reserve Program, which has been, I can't recall off the top of my head when it started, but it's been working with farmers for a really long time to set aside part of their property and either restore it as wildlife habitat or protect it from further agricultural development. That program has worked pretty well. There's no similar program in urban and suburban areas. So that could be a wonderful way to incentivize people to make change. Like imagine if you had some tax incentive to set aside half of your yard so that it's not lawn anymore. Now it's a meadow for monarch butterflies. I would sign up for that. and there's a lot of, I mean, when we think about the where the conversation is happening in terms of private land for conservation, it's agriculture. And it is true that agriculture takes up a large proportion of our country, and agriculture is critical for supporting our population of humans. But there's also a huge proportion of the nation that's also developed as residential and urban and suburban areas as well. And so, you know, I like to say, you know, we're talking about these working lands and how we can use them for conservation, but we also need to talk about where we live as well. So our living lands, and thinking about if we can initiate kind of similar programs like that, especially so that we can tear down some of those barriers on who can purchase the plants that they need to make their yard or their urban park ecologically functional. Like who is able to remove those invasive plants or clean the water or put in ponds? We need to make sure that that's equitable as well.
One thing I was going to kind of say that's, I think, an interesting layer onto what Desiree was saying is we've invested a ton as a community for decades now into conservation and agricultural landscapes, which I think is a great thing. That's not a critique of that. I think part of that's an interesting kind of cultural perception, though, of how we view agricultural lands as a part of nature or working as that's you're working the land as if it's an aspect of nature that you're a part of. I don't think we have the same perception of our city or suburban areas as also part of nature in the same way, despite the fact that something like lawn is like the most heavily cultivated plant in the country, in the world, probably. And we, you know, have tons of plants out there. We're modifying everything about the plant landscape. We don't really perceive that as working the land the same way as being part of nature. And I think, you know, for that same token, conservation initiatives haven't really caught up to urban and suburban areas for that reason, because they're kind of considered dramatically other than nature, or we don't have that same sort of social cultural perspective of agricultural areas as being other than nature. They're considered a modification of nature. And so maybe it's a little bit of a cultural lens probably that we need to shift for where we invest conservation going forward.
Yeah, I'm glad. It makes me happy to hear you both bring up lawns. My neighbors hate me because I mow my lawn at the highest possible setting on my lawnmower, and I tend to let it go longer than everyone else in the neighborhood. You know, just for the aspect of letting even just something as simple as clover go to flower, things like that. And the reason why I bring up the idea of sort of conservation easements and private land is because, as you've mentioned, you know, we have already developed so much of our land, and it's only going to get more. Like, our developed land is going to encompass more and more and more of the available space. And, you know, if we can set aside some of that land that's maybe on the edge of suburban USA or something, you know, if a you know, a couple buildings are torn down in the middle of, say, Pittsburgh, you know, maybe we don't have to put a building right back there. Maybe we can have even something as simple as a community garden, you know, that while I know that's not necessarily wildlife, at least it's more of a green space that I can't see how that could really harm anyone other than maybe the city's tax dollars that come in. But this initiative is coming from directly from the White House. Is this initiative enough, or is there more that the Biden administration and Congress and every politician, is there something that can be done to make this more than just an initiative and actually, you know, a plan in motion?
I don't know if this is going to answer your question, but I kind of want to build on a little bit about what you're saying about like making green space and like setting aside habitat and kind of to speak to a little bit about what our piece is saying. So conservation has many layers, right? One of it is to actually set aside land, and that conserves wildlife or plant communities or restore it so that it actually is doing something that has a meaningful impact to sustaining populations, right? But part of conservation is how we're involved in that too, okay? And so, you know, one of the things that I think will help, you know,
influence the administration to actually doing something is buy-in by the public, right? So if we have more people that are saying, this is necessary, we want this, we need this, and we want you to spend our tax dollars, and we're gonna go to our representatives and we're gonna demand that this is part of our thinking and how our cities are developed or what issues are you gonna spend your time thinking about? Part of that is our voice in the conversation. And so one of the things that Max and I wanted to speak about in this article is, you know, when we start to involve the places that we live in conservation, it's not just about supporting the plants and animals. It's about getting us involved. Like Max was saying, like making sure that nature is not an other, you know, that or that our yards are not other land, that it's a part of this ecological community. And so when we, you know, we see this again and again, when people start learning. So if you go out in your backyard right now, like even if it's like a lawn with a couple of trees and you start looking on each one of those leaves or get your binoculars out and look in the trees, you're going to see wildlife. There are birds that need your, that need that green space as habitat. We're just finishing up spring migration in Northeast, in the Northeast US now. And all of the yards had beautiful warblers all over it. But most of them go by without anybody even noticing it. And so, you know, when you start to think of your yard as habitat, when you start to pay attention to what sort of plants do I have? What sort of animals do I have? They start to have names. You start to recognize them. You start to, you know, get excited about seeing them. And that's gonna start inspiring a broader conservation effort by people, because they're going to start caring about, you know, what's going on in my local park, like, where are my tax dollars going, how am I voting, right? These are all different ways that we can participate in conservation. And one of the things that we, you know, argue about is that when we incorporate conservation into these urban suburban areas, it can inspire people. And if our own president isn't doing that at home, why should I restore my habitat at home? And I really think it can be a wonderful example to get people involved, and that will help make the push for the administration. It'll be the kind of a two-way street. It'll help push our representatives to start doing something instead of just saying something as well.
Are you suggesting that maybe the White House stops cutting the grass and gets some goats? Like was done in, you know, the 1800s to manicure those grass.
Well, I'm just saying there's lots of small different ways that they could change in how the White House is landscaped, and that will start promoting wildlife and other biodiversity to use that green space. And so, you know, one of the things that we speak about in the article is planting native plants. So, you know, what if the administration decides, hey, guess what, everyone? We're gonna be planting oak trees and some cherry trees and some viburnums and some goldenrod. And we're doing this intentionally so that we can support our pollinators and our songbirds that live in Washington, DC. What a great example that is, right? If we're like interviewing the president and there's like beautiful monarch butterflies like flying along in the background. I think I remember there was an interview that Obama did where there was a catbird that was singing in the background and everyone was talking about it. They were like, what's that bird? What is that bird? What is that bird making that noise? And then it's like, it's a catbird. Oh, catbirds. Oh, that's that gray bird. I've seen that in my yard. Like those kind of small things, we're not gonna mow our lawn as much because we want flowers to come back for our native bees. We're going to intentionally plant an oak tree so that we can support migrating birds. We're going to put in a pond because we want to support our aquatic turtles that live in DC and have a wonderful little population right there on the grounds. Like those sort of changes are going to be really inspiring to other people to think, well, hey, maybe I'll put a pond in my yard and see what's going to end up there as well. Maybe I'll get some frogs and some tadpoles.
You know, is this enough? What can the president do? What can the administration do? What can Congress do? I think part of what Desiree's saying there, and I think what we strongly feel is that part of this is reimagining conservation and land protection beyond just the big national parks that we romanticize, which we should romanticize. These are phenomenal pieces of the landscape that have remarkable cultural, historical value and ecological value. But to, you know, take that one step further, many steps further even, and talk about that in our suburbs and our cities, and in the way that individual regional groups, city governments, and individual homeowners can take a big role in conservation right in their backyards. And, you know, part of me has this romantic vision of, you know, National Park Service or Fish and Wildlife Service doing their, you know, annual biodiversity counts of birds and pollinators. On the White House having, you know, Secret Service out there, you know, shepherding some folks around to check some camera traps for foxes on the White House grounds, or why the other mammal that happens to be there, you know, seeing nest boxes in all over the White House grounds instead of just trees. And, you know, I'm sure Secret Service was going to hate having an unkempt lawn because it's so much harder to keep track of what's going on surveillance wise. But that just, to me, sounds so exciting. I had this, the most famous residential property in the world, be a place where people actually do conservation research and conservation action. And that's part of what we see in the backdrop of everyday, you know, footage of the president going about their daily duties.
Yeah, I can't agree more. I think that would be awesome. And I'll go out and say it, that I think they should stop cutting the grass. You know, if you want to manage it, don't cut it. Let's get some goats, right, that can keep it from getting too crazy, but at the same time still provide habitat for songbirds and insects and possibly even mammals, you know, at some point. And I'm right with you romanticizing this idea of, yeah, okay, I go to Washington, D.C., I want to see the White House, right? You know, when I was there a couple years ago, I wanted to see the White House. It's from a distance, you know, I get all that, but it would be even better for someone like myself to be able to see, you know, do a little bird watching. Not that, you know, while you're there, like being able to see birds. Desiree, you mentioned, you know, migrations are starting to sort of wrap up, and my wife and I were just talking this spring about how we have seen more orioles this year in southwestern Pennsylvania than I can ever remember, to the point where she didn't even know what kind of bird it was at first because she couldn't remember ever actually seeing an oriole. And I remember growing up with one of my favorite baseball teams being the Baltimore Orioles. Like,
oh, heck yeah. Go O's.
Cal Ripken Jr. was my favorite player growing up. So, of course. But, you know, I got an oriole feeder, like trying to get orioles to come to my parents' house. And in 10 years of that, maybe two that I had ever seen. And now this year, I feel like they're everywhere. And I don't know enough to be able to say like, oh, the numbers of orioles are definitely up. I'm just noticing them this year. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if more people, and, you know, like my wife noticing this bird for the first time, really taking notice of it, I think seeing that kind of stuff is going to inspire more people to get behind a 30 by 30. Well, how can we, as you both said, how much better can it get than the, you know, most famous real estate in the entire world showcasing something that any of us could be doing to some extent to try to help out. So is there anything else about this sort of example that you would like to see happen specifically?
One of the most important kind of things about what we would like to see, especially if we start talking about urban conservation and restoration, is that green space is more equitable and more evenly distributed. And so that's been kind of a big problem with thinking about, especially kind of in this world of, like, there's a lot of people that are really interested in backyard restoration and planting native plants and putting in you know, new green spaces, but you know, what we see is that there's only some people that can afford to do that. There are only some communities that are able to protect land. And then also, you know, sometimes some restoration or some protection is happening without actually consulting the communities that are there and saying, like, does this work for you? Do you feel safe if, you know, if we're gonna keep this green space set aside with no walking trails, but we're gonna keep it for bird conservation, right? So one of the things that we wanna see, you know, we want this this conversation about including urban and suburban areas in the conversation to start. We want our president to be a part of that conservation and to be an inspiration to the broader public. But then we also want to see going forward that the opportunities for protection and restoration are equitable among communities, especially low-income communities, communities of color. We want to make sure that these communities are a part of the conversation to make sure that, again, like I think I was saying before, we want win-win solutions. We don't want to just say, you can't do that anymore. You can't use that land. That land belongs to Orioles now, right? We want to make sure that people are involved in that land, that they feel that they are stewards of that land, that they feel that they're a part of it, and that they're a part of the conversation about moving forward to protect it. And so that's really the important thing. And again, why urban and suburban areas are a really important part of this 30 by 30 solution is to get people involved in that conversation and to get them invested as stewards.
And I think, Jason, you kind of had this, you know, little story earlier of, you know, if we knocked down a couple buildings in somewhere like Philly or Pittsburgh, you know, we put that as a community garden, does that count as nature? And to me, as yes, that counts as nature completely. I'd rather have there be a community garden there, because that, you know, people cultivating plants is a form of people engaging with nature in some big, meaningful way. But it also immediately goes into the idea and aspects of equity and justice, and health justice in particular, and who has access to clean, healthy food that they can be involved with. And I think the idea of taking the White House, you know, putting native plants is great, 100% for it, but this should also be about how you can grow community gardens as well. Michelle Obama started that as part of what she was doing on the White House grounds, and that can be part of this natural landscape, is thinking about how we grow food in our cities and suburbs as part of what we do. And some folks, that may be their only access to nature. They don't have their own backyard. If you're a renter, if you don't have a big enough yard to do a whole lot with, having a community garden may be your best engagement. You'll still get birds there, you'll still get native insects. And you know, conservation is going to have to include a more kind of comprehensive conversation about health justice, about a whole diversity of axes of justice that are a part of this game, beyond just the planting of native plants and trying to take care of our birds and mammals. People are a big part of that equation. So the most diverse sex of humanity we can get into conservation also means that we're going to have to talk about what is conservation in a more comprehensive way.
I'm not ignorant to the fact that I'm extremely privileged, right? I grew up in a semi-rural area. I have family property north of where we live that's 70 acres. I was brought up in a hunting lifestyle, like the idea of being outdoors, having access to it, and then the means to be able to get to it is something that I was privileged to have growing up and continue to have. But when you bring up low-income families, urban landscapes, some of these people not only don't have the means to grow their own backyard garden because they're in an apartment complex, but they might not even be able to get to something like a state park to be able to experience the outdoors. So if we can be a little more equitable in bringing these green spaces closer to more people, it's going to help inspire more kids and more people to be interested in conservation, interested in the outdoors, which is going to give people like myself more and other and more people to be a voice of what I'm, you know, what the three of us are trying to do. So I think that is something that has to be talked about and has to be brought up and discussed and, you know, remedied, quite honestly.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things that's happening in conversations about urban ecosystems is there's a big recognition of the importance of tree canopy and how when we increase the canopy of trees, we can clean our air, clean our water, we can have shade to reduce temperatures. And there's folks that have documented patterns of inequity in tree canopy distributions. But I mean, fortunately, a lot of our cities on the East Coast anyway, those are the cities I'm most familiar with, are really aiming to increase their tree canopies across the city. I mean, I think some of the goals are upwards to like 40% or 50% for the city. I think the goal for DC is 40% of the city. And so that's wonderful, right? If we have city involvement to invest money in increasing our tree canopies, across the metropolitan area. That's great for people. If it's done equitably again, if we can do that, but also support birds and insects and other wildlife, then we're getting lots of things done. We're killing many birds with one stone is the terrible maxim that fits there. So we can get a lot of goals done with the same thing if we're planting tree canopies that are supporting wildlife intentionally. I mean, imagine if you get, the city puts a wonderful, elm tree outside your house and it provides shade to your house. It's beautiful to look at, but then it also supports migrating birds. Like that's good for everyone. But instead, if they were planting something like a ginkgo tree or something that doesn't get tall enough to provide shade, well, then we're not reaching those same, we're not getting the same services. So we have to think about how can we do this intentionally? How can we have specific goals that include both people and biodiversity in all of our decision-making?
Well, Max, Desiree, this has been a great conversation. It's a conversation we're going to need to continue to have, right, in our country, in other countries. As you said, there's up to 50 other countries, sort of supporting this idea of 30 by 30. So we need to continue to have these conversations and continue trying to get that snowball effect. You know, if we can get more equitable green spaces, you're going to have more people interested and passionate about it, which are going to be more people willing to either donate money or do boots on the ground, volunteer work or whatever it is to make more green spaces, which is going to get more people, that snowball effect. These conversations are the way that we can start getting that snowball rolling down the mountain a little bit faster. So thank you both for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
That does it for another episode. I have to thank Max and thank Desiree for coming on and speaking with me. I definitely want to talk with them, whether on the record or off the record, many, many more times, just to pick their brains about ways that Conserve the Wild can help in the mitigation efforts with urbanization that we have. Obviously, since that's our main goal as an organization, it makes sense that we're going to talk about it a lot. But the reason why we're talking about it a lot, the reason why it's the mission of Conserve the Wild, is because it's serious concern. Whether you want to tie it to endangered species or threatened species or wild places or climate change, I don't care. Add it wherever you want. Tie it in however you want. It's an important issue because it's a finite resource, and it's something that we need to work to make sure that we either preserve or conserve it, one way or the other, right? Or both. If you did not stop this podcast after the intro to read the article, I highly, highly recommend that you go read it now. And the reason why is because they're right. We need to set examples. Those of us that think that these are the things that need to be done as far as conservation is concerned, we need to be setting the example for the rest of the country. And like you heard in the conversation, why not start with the most prominent piece of real estate in the entire world? Why not start right there on the grounds of the White House? Let's plant pollinator gardens. Let's plant native species. Let's allow that perfectly manicured lawn to become something of a wildlife haven. All it's going to do is inspire others to do the same. I encourage you to go out and do those same things. Plant a native tree. That might be an oak, that might be a chestnut, that might be a pine tree, whatever it is that is native. Find out what is native in your area, plant that kind of tree. Plant those kinds of seeds, those pollinator mixes, whatever you can. Heck, start small. Don't mow your lawn. Let it grow taller, right? Don't mow it so low. Your neighbors aren't going to like it. I know, right? I'm right there. I already do that. My neighbors aren't real happy. I don't care. I'm doing what's best, what I feel is best for wildlife to the best of my ability in my current circumstances. So I encourage you to go out and do that. And hopefully you do this week, next week, today, tomorrow. After you're done doing that, I'll see you next week. And while you're doing it, stay wild.